I mean, I'm also a minister. To give you an idea, I'm a Baptist minister too. And black male Baptist ministers are known for not approving other ministers. And I go into pulpits and churches where I'm welcome. The older men who don't believe in women preachers will treat me with all the courtesy and respect that's due any preacher. It's the younger ones who give me the heart.
And their feeling is?
They won't shake my hand. They, you know, it's like, you know, the other ones, you know, it's, you know, when I'm in my brother's church, I may not agree with him on this issue of women minister, but I will respect you. And they'll give you the title, too. Okay. It's the younger ones who they'll just avoid. They'll go to the other side of the room. They'll do anything.
Why? Because you're intruding on their preserve?
Yeah. And they see, some have argued it's the only place where we're allowed to be leaders in this society.
So it's again.
We're allowed to be men. See, and that's the problem. When you get leadership linked with malehood, but that link.
Which is what Morning Head did and that whole era did. That's
yeah, that whole link. And there's also a linguistic coinciding at the same time where when the change goes from Negro to black, Negro was always a gender inclusive term. When people started, instead of talking about the Negro's personhood, they start talking about the black man's personhood, you begin to get a tendency towards exclusive language. And I mean, it's like two freight trains sort of coming together and sort of joining forces rather than smashing one another and canceling them out. But so, I mean, on personal experiential terms, the older men are much easier to deal with. You know, even in situations where they're dying to be sexist, they're cool. You know, they at least have good manners.
But it's not so easy to generalize about the women.
No.
There's a lot more.
The women are suffering. I mean, the black women my age and younger are suffering because of the fact that there is more different divergence in terms of supporting them, particularly if they're coming from families with three generations of dual career professionals, and they go out there and, you know, all of a sudden all those little dudes that they would normally meet have run off and met these women who fit more appropriately to what has been communicated to them is appropriate for a good image for the race.
Yeah. I understand that blacks had difficulty and struggle for a long time, generations, until they reached where they are now. I'm from Korean background. As you know, some of those Oriental background, women are called many times whose wife or whose mother, or instead of being called by her own name.
Oh.
It's been changed a little, but still there are some tendencies. So I would like to have your opinion. What do you think for Oriental women to develop their own organization to help ourselves? And maybe possible, whether it's possible to work with the counterculturally, like with other ethnic groups, let's say blacks or whites, whether it's advisable, then what will be the advantages or what will be the calculated risks? Let's say, even if I want to join them, if they don't accept me, there is no way, like I have to get the job to get the experience. So what are the feelings about Oriental people before, when we had a huge number of people, many of them, they just studied, went home. But these days, more people are coming here to live, generation after generation. Our numbers are not that big as yet. And so, compared to the number you black people had, it's not really comparable. So whether it's strong enough to have our own, or take a risk to approach the other cultural background.
Well, where I work in Brooklyn, there were a lot of Korean families.
And on the block where there was that summer lunch program that I was talking about, there were several, well, quite a few households where they had Korean families living. And they, the women or the men didn't come to the block association meeting. I think part of it was that they couldn't speak English very well, a lot of them. But part of it also was, I think, being afraid that they wouldn't, you know, be included and this kind of thing. And I would think that living under the conditions, you know, that people are living in, that there are a lot of issues which would be common issues, that would be something that you could work, you know, with the people who are undergoing the same problems, finding jobs, the same problems, you know, providing food for their families, the same problems with daycare, and probably would be a place where it could be, you know, across, well, it is a very, where I was working, quite a multi-ethnic group that's working in those areas. But I think also that you are working with people who are not, that I think there will be also some problems. You know, that it's a question of, it's not so easy working in multi-ethnic situations, and there are going to be a lot of bigotry among certain people, but I don't think it's that common. I think that because of the common issues, it works out generally that people are working together. Yeah. That would be my idea, but I don't know if you know. At least from the fieldwork that I, you know, the particular situation, it may be very different.
I think one of my students did a study of community workers in Chinatown. And it was interesting because the historical roots were different, and it reflected the historical differences in terms of how. And you know, you had said Asian women generally, and I mean the historical specificity of the emergence of their roles was really specific to Chinese American history. In other words, how and how roles of women had changed. I think so. That was one thing. Yet she was able to identify quite. She had gone at it from a different point of view. And it was like this serendipitous accident where we sort of were able to put our heads together. And she was doing study of Chinese women who were professional, and in the process found out how they were attached to their communities and really doing these same roles. And it was just amazing because they were busy, they had these same busy lifestyles as the women I had studied, and doing all those things. Cross-ethnic ties, though, are more difficult. There was a group of us in Boston who put together a Third World Women's. We put together a committee, Third World Women's Committee for International Women's Day. And we wanted, after we pulled off this big, huge conference to which 1,100 Third World Women showed up, to make a more permanent organization. But the organization fell apart, and I think some of the reasons that it fell apart are still very salient, even 10 years later or 8 years later. One of the reasons were some very, everybody's perceptions of your own group. When you're working within your own community, you know this ideological work that I was talking about, where you have to deal with the problem of miseducation about yourself. Funny thing about the dominant culture is that they manage to communicate these other messages about other groups, and the other group absorbs that, but unless you have, you know, somebody out from the community working full time to undo all of that, they still retain, and I think this is a reality, particularly, and it's a sad reality among peoples of color in the United States, is that they tend to share dominant culture perspectives of groups other than themselves.
Yeah.
And that's a big problem. Just getting to the point, and it erupts in funny ways. The New England Women's Studies Association had a meeting centered around racism a couple of years ago, and they had workshops for white women to deal with their racism. And then while the white women were in workshops to deal with their racism, women of color were supposed to be in these things to learn and share.
was, I mean, I haven't been back to a New England Women's Studies Association meeting since, to give you an idea of how the different perceptions of other groups where, you know, was Puerto Rican women, the Hispanic women were largely Puerto Rican women. There were a few Chicano women who were going to school in Boston. And then you had women who were from some of the other communities that have emerged in the Boston area, from Latin America. And there was hostility between them and the black women. And the sort of the Asian women, most of whom were Chinese American women, were just ignored. They were sort of over in a corner and ignored. It was just, it wasn't a disaster because it was learning. I mean, you realize the work you have to do to be able to pull people together. But then the other point of the matter is because people have different histories, they have different issues in terms of what the problem is. Racial oppression has not operated the same way for every group. And then when you throw in groups who are recently immigrated from someplace with people who are native several generations, it's Pauline Carolan said it's like apples and oranges to get it, because the way in which the United States Immigration Service has screened people has made for some sometimes very severe and sometimes very subtle ideological and attitudinal differences. So it's going to take a lot of work. That's like a big, huge community work problem all in itself, in terms of trying to teach people that, you know, civil rights is not the problem with Native Americans. No, there are very specific dimensions of racial oppression you must understand for this group's history. Ignore the fact that they have a larger proportion of middle class folks than you do. I mean, there's all real sort of political differences in political economy. So it's a big problem that's going to take work, serious, hard work on the part of people who are willing to talk to one another and really willing to learn, and development of some theoretical categories, particularly in the way in which gender and race come together, that help us interpret these different streams of history with reference to the larger structure. So there's just a whole lot of issues.
I think we should take two more. It's lunchtime.
She's been trying to get a question.
About generations.
Could spot, you know, in generational differences in women's neighborhood activism. I mean, do you have to be around 40 with a couple of kids to be a neighborhood leader? What about the women in their 20s? Are they active in these things? You know, are the youngest women actually more interested in careers and jobs and not focusing in on these neighborhood problems? You know, have there been changes? This is not. With your work in Cheryl's, you have, you know, 50 or 60 years worth of women's neighborhood activities.
Well, I would say in where I worked, it was certainly the older women were very much involved in bringing in the younger women. And I don't think it was just women in their 40s who were neighborhood activists. Women in their 20s were very involved. And, you know, it's not a question of career, really, versus being involved in the neighborhood. I mean, I don't think people saw it that way. Most of the women that I worked with were not going on to be doctors and lawyers at that point, you know, and they were secretaries, or they were, some of them got high school equivalencies and they were going on to take courses, but they were not in the position of saying. In fact, the ones that were going on to college were often some of the most active in the neighborhood of the younger women. And the older women hadn't, most of them, you know, had that much college experience. So I think there was a big effort. First of all, there's not that generational split within the community. There's the mothers and the daughters, basically. You know,
yes.
So that the grandmothers could be in their 40s and the daughters in their 20s and the children 7 and 8, you know. So it was more like within families and in that kind of relationship, even though it might not be mother-daughter, very much. Both groups involved, and the older women too. You know, I don't think you see that generational split in activities. You may see it in the point of view people take, but not in their involvement in the activities. At least that was my.
I had an intergenerational situation. The youngest one in my study at public study was 32, I think. And that was because of the way I had defined a population that had to have been publicly recognized 8 years prior to the commencement of the study, which meant I had to be able to document it, but some of this was besides community reputation. So that left dropped out a lot of people. But the youngest one in my study was one of the most prominent people. So it was not that, but also my analysis of Black women's history started out going backwards into their networks when they talk about who recruited them, who their role models were. I saw it was very clearly an intergenerational legacy, and that's why when you kept going backwards, it fit right into this larger historical structure. It was an institution that learned to perpetuate itself and yet adapt for changing politics, changing political needs, and changing situations.
You know, I asked the question is because not in neighborhood politics, but in formal politics like, say, our abortion rights group in New York, Harassa, it's generationally segregated. There just aren't that many women in their 20s active in the group. You know, it's an organization of women.
But also experiential differences. That older group is the one who risked their lives.
Yeah.
The younger group, you know, this is the same reality. They've got it, you know, and they don't realize the threat to it.
Yeah. Those should have maybe but characteristic of reproductive.
Or were in that generation who could have almost died, or could have died. They're the ones who are, and they're also like, if you go to hear some of these people, I remember being in the room, it was an older woman who was sitting, and when this woman, Mildred Jefferson, was Boston, it was the older women who were sitting in the back almost in tears, because they were the ones who were most affected by all this rhetoric, and really knew what they had risked and knew that, you know, what she was saying lies in a sense.
Well, I'd just like to comment as a woman in my early 20s that a lot of the reason I think that I've worked at a natural childbearing center for my whole way through college. I think part of the reason why people who are in school today don't get involved in those kind of things is because we're told that we should be professional. We're told we should go beyond that. We're told that being active is a threat to our economic life. And I think that that's a really, really strong message that comes down to people who are in school now.
From where?
Well, I don't know exactly, but from, you know, from the people who are going to employ you, from the people who are going to let you into graduate school, from all these different sources, and I think it's very influential right now. I mean, the Reagan administration is just the perfect example of that kind of attitude that's alive in society today, and I think that that we get a lot of that pressure, and that's perhaps
don't you think
why
it's a social class thing too.
I don't know.
Because you have to have that option in order to be unwilling to take risks. You have to have that option to risk.
Okay.
So
it's
a possibility for you.
Yes, sir. Yeah, me too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.